This week's episode of Still Entitled is made possible by WiseCam. Wise is on a mission to make amazing smart home products accessible to everyone. The Wise indoor camera is packed with premium features that allow you to see everything from anywhere for only $20. Whether you're checking to see if your kids are home safe or if your 3D printer has finished printing, nothing is off limits for WiseCam. Go to wise.com/untitled. That's WYZE.com/untitled. Be guaranteed the lowest price available. Now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
I'm really glad that Norm messed it up this time instead of me. It's very exciting.
Wow, they didn't hear that.
Oh,
I cut that.
You're gonna put the whole thing. You should just start the whole thing in.
No.
Okay, just put it at the end.
So, album of the year this year at the Grammys was a bit controversial because there was a tremendous amount of amazing work that was up for the award, and it was won by a terrific country artist named Kacey Musgraves, who we've loved for a long time. She has this song on this new album about meeting a guy who's like a little standoffish, and the chorus is, "You can have your space, cowboy."
Wow.
And I was like, how is it possible no one's come up with that rhetorical flourish before now?
Well, it's which only works because for people who know Space Cowboy.
Yeah. Come on. Space Cowboy is huge.
You worked on it, so you can see.
No, not the movie Space Cowboy.
No, it's from the end of
the song. It's the song by, some call me a space cowboy.
But it's also from the end of Cowboy Bebop. Every episode closes with "See a Space Cowboy."
Well, there you go. See?
I just have
common term and phrase.
The filmmaking reference.
But her previous album called Pageant Material is an unfettered delight, and I listen to it every morning. Now I wake up and I go, Alexa, please play Pageant Material by Kacey Musgraves.
And now everybody's Alexa's playing Pageant Material by Kacey Musgraves.
You're welcome, everybody.
Okay, Google, play Pageant Material by Kacey Musgraves. We'll cover everybody. We'll do a Hey Siri in a minute.
She has this song called Family is Family. In church or in prison, you get what you get, and you don't get to pick them. They might smoke like chimneys, or they'll give you their kidneys. Friends come in handy, but family is family. I love that.
That's great.
Yeah, it's really great.
It's very sweet.
Yeah. A little too real.
For some.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking of awards, I want to go right into it. It made me think about the Academy Awards, which I know we had talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But recently...
You guys talked about it.
We talked about it.
We specifically waited until you were gone.
Do you have thoughts?
Yeah, it's fine.
We don't care about it.
Okay. I like. But it turns out host is good.
And
I didn't even watch him. I was sick.
I just watched it on Twitter. So people post who wins, and then if it looked like it was an interesting speech, I watched the speech on YouTube.
Right. We had talked about this. Right. But Steven Spielberg had. There's a story about him talking about his maybe some displeasure about Netflix and Roma.
Yeah,
spending so much money, Netflix, to promote a movie like Roma when they don't have to do what the studio system does, which is this spend money on distribution because they own a distribution channel.
Right.
And so,
oh man,
it's been spun as a story about him, trying to oust Netflix from contention for the Academy Awards. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
It is poor optics to do it after a film like Roma, which so celebrates a non-white perspective, a non-United States, non-white perspective upon the world, that's the linchpin that starts the ball rolling against Netflix. I don't disagree that there are obviously there are disparities in what they can spend, but hell's bells, like it's nothing but good that Roma got made in the way that it did, and the ethos behind it, and that the whole world gets to see it. I've been following this debate on Twitter a lot,
right? Like that Spielberg, whatever the end goal is, or whatever the way he's going about it, but his end goal is to trying to preserve and celebrate the theatrical experience, which unfortunately has been diminishing over the years because
actually,
of the way
it's been raising in the last couple of years, hasn't it? I think overall
attendance
movie
is
ticket
down,
sales
monies are up.
Oh, okay, all right, that's what's going on.
Yeah,
I mean it's still around, and I think the goal of getting people in the seats and preserving that, however that is evolving, because that definitely is not the same as it was 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. With IMAX and Dolby and 3D.
I mean, it's not a people in a tent with a hand exactly. projector. Yeah.
Right, right.
And an accordion.
That is admirable. I don't see those goals as mutually exclusive.
No, I don't think so either.
I mean, here's the thing. It seems disingenuous from Spielberg, given the history of the Academy Awards and why they were originally created, which was by the massive distribution system to throw a bone to the actors so that they would stop complaining so much and just make more movies.
Oh, is that really?
Yeah. what's his name? Meyer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Louis Meyer, is that right? Like, was like, hey, we need to do something to keep the talent in line. So let's put on a big awards thing and, you know, send them all out there and give them some statues and then see if they do their. Yeah. Anyway.
Will's ranting is clipping in my headphones.
I apologize. Sometimes I guess.
Take a step back.
Look, sir. Look.
And especially in exactly to your point, Adam, in the past couple of years where the Oscars have been criticized for being archaic as an institution.
The criticism
is
warranted and completely correct.
So, but to take one step back, if the crux of the argument is what is film and what deserves to be celebrated...
So I don't think that that's the crux of the argument. I mean,
but that is the more interesting argument to have.
Well, actually, I think it goes one step even further. How do we take in our meat? I mean, look, I'm confronting this right now. I'm making a television show after 2.5 years of making content in here. And what I've come to understand by listening to the people that watch me on television, watch our stuff untested here, is those two use cases are completely different. I mean, they're radically different consciousnesses about taking in media. When people watch YouTube videos, they often put our stuff up at the end of their workbench or craft table or apartment while they're doing something else, and we spend time together. It's a very congenial, there's something totally much more personal about that than sitting down and watching a movie. That being said, I've been watching a lot more movies lately because my attention span is diminished to the size of a matchstick. Because I watch short things all day long.
That's
and I've been
why we have
to
the Webbies.
Put more movies into me. And it is a totally different consciousness. It takes a specific amount of time, and I devote a certain portion of my brain
to it. Put your phone down.
And when companies like Netflix are, and this is a dumb word, but it applies here, really disrupting the standard way films have been made, I think ultimately that's a net good because you end up with a lot more experimentation and the studios aren't doing experimentation. We talked about Bull Durham last week.
Oh, good God.
I just started watching it again.
Oh, it's an April tradition in my house.
Oh, it's a terrific movie. Yeah. But what's really surprising is it's a wholesome romantic comedy where people say the F word and cursing
in
constantly
like
throughout it. It's a hard R film that's a sweet romantic comedy at the same time. And that doesn't exist right now.
I think it does, actually.
The $20 million movie. Right. Everything's $100 million. Everything is the world at stake.
What do you think
Bridesmaids is a hard R comedy.
Bridesmaids is 7 years old.
Okay, it's a bad example. Game Night is a better, closer example.
Game Night, okay.
It's a sweet romantic
game
comedy.
Game Night, but Tag, would you put Tag in there?
Yeah.
Tag's also
Tag
in there?
Tag is probably
so
in
I
there.
Think Game Night and Tag are not nearly, I mean, so we're talking that if those are the examples, we're way out of the golden age of great romantic comedies.
I mean, I would say
Crazy Rich Asians.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a delightful movie, but it's.
But it does feel like an anomaly.
It does. It does.
In the way it got made.
Was it rated R?
No, it wasn't. Okay, so you're talking about rated R.
Only saying that there are ways, and I'm not using the R rating to make an example that we should be cursing more in movies. I'm just saying that these things change over time, and that change is, it can be good, it can be bad, we can calcify into different things, but I think that what Netflix and Amazon and Apple and Hulu and all these other platforms are doing is not just changing the way the industry works, but it's giving us different ways to take in our media, and that... The shape of everything is changing. As content creators, we're totally attuned to this, and we don't know what the answer is going to be.
The lines are blurred.
The thing that's happened across all media is that either you have to make something incredibly cheap with really low overhead and plan to make your money back if you're lucky, or you grab some sort of tiger by its tail and you accidentally buy Marvel if you're Disney and you crank out 19 movies and make $20 billion over the next 10 years. There's really not much of an in-between anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's occasional anomalies. Crazy Rich Asians is one of them.
And hopefully its success yields many more.
I mean, but it's not going to. It never does. Because it's the same thing that happened with My Big Fat Greek Wedding, frankly. you know, it was a movie that had massive word of mouth and grew over a long period of time, which was against the current trend.
Right.
And then it's not like we saw a bunch of romantic comedies that spun out of that.
Yeah.
It just they did a sequel and it didn't make as much money, and then nobody did it again.
Hmm. I mean, that, and the argument for Netflix is that they give long legs to the flash in the pans.
Well, I mean, also what Netflix, I mean, so Kristen, who we work with, one of my producers, is she talks about how great it is to promote stuff. When she was working on promoting White Rabbit with Cary Grant and Tori, it's great because a good portion of their audience, like our audience, is international.
Yeah.
And so when I tweet about, you know, Mythbusters Jr. airing in the U.S. and I can't get numbers from Discovery about when it's airing in Canada, in South America, Central America, Asia, Europe, those people follow us in all of those places and want to know that kind of stuff. And Netflix makes that trivial.
Well, so there's the thing that they did is, you know, half of a, but of, if a movie costs $100 million to make, often the studio will spend another $75 or $100 million marketing it.
Jesus
right?
Christ.
So right. It's so a spectacular amount of money. This is what Spielberg is talking about.
Right.
He's not talking about like sending tapes to discs to movie theaters. He's talking about paying for marketing and advertising.
Yeah, understood.
And Netflix bypasses that because everybody turns on the TV at night and goes straight to the Netflix menu and plays Menu Hero for 10 minutes.
Yeah. And they don't need to pay for prints to be made. They don't need to pay the theater chains.
Yeah, but that stuff is nothing compared to ads.
It's still, I mean, it's not compared to the ads.
Theater
chains. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But that's still a big part of, that's why independent films who aren't picked up by Netflix have a very tough time in the awards because they don't get distribution in the same way. But just in the format of film, we can all agree that 90 minute to 2 hour story, it's the same.
Well,
Roma and Avengers Infinity War are both films, both movies.
Absolutely.
And the Academy is about celebrating that form.
So there's a really interesting article I came across that talked about that the very last time the studios, I already talked about this on the podcast, that the studios had a hostless Oscars was 1968-69. At the very moment, the studio system was dying, and young brash filmmakers like John Cassavetes and were bringing up films that were super cheap with amazing performances and amazing writing in them, and that engendered this whole radical shift in film into the early 70s. So that they pointed out that happened at this pivot point in film.
So I was going to say, the thing that hasn't happened as much with film as it has happened with online video and even TV to a lesser extent is that the democratization of the process hasn't gone down. And part of it is that you know, with a podcast, the stuff that we have sitting on our desk would have cost $15,000 or $20,000 10 or 12 years ago. And now it's less than a grand to get everything you need to have a 3-person podcast in your living room.
And this is why I love what Neil Blomkamp is doing with Oates Studio. I love that he is, let's build a Roger Corman model where the quality now is 10 times what it was when Roger Corman was putting ships on sticks and filming them with cameras. And make some compelling stories.
He's doing everything from short films, full-length films, to commercial projects, doing advertisements for, you know, people want to have a Neil Blomkamp film.
Yeah, and he's literally, he's renting out an old shopping mall in Vancouver to do this.
It's why we built the animation studio that we built with Foo.
Right.
Is so that you can, instead of, you know, spending, you know, 6 months pre-production on a TV show and then shipping it off for 50 weeks to Southeast Asia or Africa to be animated and then getting it back and doing the last cleanup and publishing it, we can do that. We can take out that 50 weeks and make it like 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, but it's not happening with film. And part of it is that distribution is hard once you get out. Although that's changing with Amazon and Hulu and Netflix and
And I think that's only good. Yeah. I think that's only good when the distribution can get wider for smaller projects.
Well, that's why it feels gross when Spielberg complains about Roma being in the Academy Awards, because it feels like he's trying to pull up the ladder after him when he's one of those people that directly benefited from the people that broke the studio system in the 60s.
Interesting. I think of Spielberg as a solidly... You're right. His career comes about at this perfect.
His career comes about at this perfect
moment in time when everything's a little bit softer.
Yeah,
and all those guys can kind of cut loose and do. But he's always been a very.
He's a genre director that had massive success because genres broke out of genres around the time he was starting.
Yeah, interesting.
Like Jaws would have been a drive-in theater movie.
You know, that was
10 years before.
You know, Jaws was on hotel television where I was on a shoot recently, and I sat and watched it one night.
It's still exceptional.
Not, I mean, it is still absolutely one of the best horror action movies ever made.
It's full stop. I mean, it's, the thing about it is, like Alien, there's hardly any action. Right? Like, yeah, it's just straight up horror. Just
face reactions. Yeah. Reactions.
Oh my God, it's Roy Scheider going whoop into frame.
Yeah, and
dolly zooms.
But yeah, that like that. Anytime somebody tries who's established and massively successful like Spielberg is, and it feels like they're pulling up the ladder, that feels icky.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
That's what that was my reaction.
Understood.
There's only been recently two films: the Coen Brothers one, Ballad Buster Scruggs, and Roma, were Netflix films. I wish
that you'd seen. I'd seen
a big screen.
Annihilation.
Yeah.
That came out in theaters
first.
But in other regions, it was
Netflix first. Exactly. And I think the convenience of Netflix, I think that turned me away from watching the theaters.
Right.
I've already spent the money. I guess I'm going to watch it on my TV, which is a fine experience. But I do kind of wish that it came out in theaters first.
You need a bigger TV, Norm.
All right. So I want to change the subject. You finished The Americans.
Oh, I did. Yes. Oh, this past weekend. We made a commitment.
So what's your vote? Am I right? Did they kind of miss their landing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we may talk some Americans.
You haven't made it through the end.
No.
I stopped after the suitcase bet.
I think that this it's a prestige television show, right? I think it's in the same family as Breaking Bad, as The Sopranos, The Wire. In that people are invested in these characters, in that type of
serial storytelling. And they're being built by wonderful ensembles of writers and directors and actors who are doing some of the best work.
And absolutely. And by nature, the story they're telling is about tension, not only between the main characters, but about these opposing forces that culminates. Like, you can feel the last season is about a culmination of the tension. And I will say, because I'm trying to talk around spoilers, the payoff for that specific buildup was 100% worth it.
It is a
12-minute scene where you are literally watching six seasons of a show for this one scene.
Come to a point.
And it's unexpected.
The characters all do things that are deeply in line and unexpected. It is astoundingly tense.
Yes.
And they also exhibit, each of the characters exhibits exactly why you love them.
So as opposed to like Breaking Bad, where they spread that moment out over... Like each character, each pair of characters kind of got their own scene.
It's hard to compare it to Breaking Bad because I think that Breaking Bad, the last eight episodes of Breaking Bad are the best television perfection I've ever seen.
Okay. And that's what I kind of wish. I wish that they, knowing that it was going to be the last season of The Americans, I wish it wasn't nine episodes of build up to essentially one scene with a lot of plot points kind of falling by the wayside. I wish they had gone
a lot of plot points were left sort of hanging chads.
I feel like the whole last season could have been the payoff.
It could, yeah.
And I would have been probably more satisfied that way. So in that, I was unsatisfied. I felt like, you know, I wanted more.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what they wanted. They left things hanging on purpose.
I mean, sometimes real life isn't satisfying. It doesn't conclude in the
But it was honest. The characters were honest to themselves, and the portrayals were amazing. It was, you know...
I kind of thought that they could have. Yeah, I thought they left money on the table. I thought at the very end they left some money on the table.
And we're not in that position. Like the writers and the directors, the showrunners have the fortunate position of they got to explore every single possibility with their rewrites, with the story. We didn't get that satisfaction.
Well, it's so easy. Look, Ben Acker the other week, writer Ben Acker was here on the podcast. And I love Ben. And I love how... Ben is very opinionated. He has really specific ideas about character and plot and how they should work. And he also has such a deep compassion for creators. And we were about to talk about something and he was like, it's so hard to make something. And he's totally right. So I'd like, you know, I always want to couch these opinion fests with the caveat that like all of these people busted their ass for the better part of a decade to make this great show.
I'm not saying it wasn't a good ending. I'm just saying that the feeling they chose to intentionally leave us with was, you know, a different type of feeling than I got from watching Breaking Bad. I think it was all intentional. I don't think they did it as a mistake.
I think you're probably right, feeling
unfulfilled in certain ways. I think that was 100% totally their intention. It's just that I would have wanted more. And that's, you know, being a fan of the show, I think... I can say I want more.
It's one of those situations where I would give a lot of money to have like recordings of the writer's room for honestly the entire run of Breaking Bad. Like, I know that putting recording devices in the writer's room is probably going to mess up the writer's room.
Well, I have a hard time imagining how Vince Gilligan, who talks like this and is super sweet, would say the most horrible, well, then I think he should take a knife and cut through his neck slowly and we'll hold the shot so the audience gets to watch the blood spurt out.
There is no Ozymandias, right? Like, in Breaking Bad, this, and I'm not going to spoil, but there was a death in the last season that just feels like, shit's getting real.
Oh, my God. Directed by Ryan Johnson.
And that happens early enough in the final season that you really like the roller.
Episode 8 of the final season?
It's around there.
Sorry. It's the hinge pin, because then they paused for like 6 months and we waited for the next 8 episodes.
And it's a roller coaster from there. More leeway, or more runway on the roller coaster at the end of The Americans.
As opposed to, say, Mad Men. Right? We're all talking about AMC shows today, I guess.
FX for Americans. Mad Men's another good example where...
I thought Mad Men stuck the landing magnificently.
Oh, it did.
And I thought that I also... We watched Mad Men again last year. Do you know there's not a... I think I already said this, but there's not a dud... I really had a hard time thinking, is any of these episodes going to be bad or even slightly less interesting? Because every show is incredible.
I think that Mad Men, every character landed perfectly except for Don.
Really?
But Don shouldn't have landed perfectly.
I think that the whole retreat storyline was meandering.
I mean, here's the thing. Don's story climaxed with the Hershey Bar episode. When he's doing the Hershey Bar pitch and he starts talking about his actual childhood instead of made-up childhood.
That's when Roger says, hey, you really shit the bed in there. And Don goes, yeah, well.
But that's the moment Don's whole story, it's been leading up to that moment. Because you know he's going to break, and he breaks. And then everything after that is a disappointment for him because he's a broken man. God.
Can we just talk for a second about what an incredible, chimeric enigma Harry Hamlin was on Mad Men. I just love his character.
Who does Harry Hamlin?
Harry Hamlin is the head of Ted Shore's agency.
Wait.
The one who talks with a beautiful sonorous voice. Are you too young to remember Harry Hamlin from Clash of the Titans and L.A. Law?
He has curly hair.
Short hair, very handsome, incredibly handsome. He's got a painting in the attic. He looks way younger than he should.
Chiseled Grecian
features. Absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, okay. He's married to Lisa Rinna. I met him at the Emmys. One year right after losing at the Emmys, I saw him and Lisa Rinna ahead of me, and I called to them, and they were insanely polite and sweet and made me feel so much better immediately. Not with any commiseration, just by being lovely humans.
Being delightful human beings.
I gotta rewatch Mad Men.
Look, Norm, if you're gonna do a Mad Men rewatch podcast, so let's get on it because I'll go back to that.
Sure, there are a couple.
Hey, so I think I'm about to join the ranks of the Canon 5D Mark IV.
Yeah, we're just talking about this. So you're looking for a new camera, and you have dabbled in both Canon and Sony. You were one of the early adopters of their mirrorless line.
I had the
R5,
the NEX 6.
One of the high end one that was amazing.
The very first
APS-C.
One with configurable buttons with no labeling on them.
Yes,
like
exactly.
That kind of first pro mirrorless. And I had the first Canon prosumer, that very first, like, all plastic one, and then I bought the Mark I, bought the Mark II, bought the Mark III, trading up each time.
And you have a great selection of lenses.
I do have a great selection of Canon lenses, and that leads me back to Canon, but really what keeps me in the Canon world is that I understand those menus.
I think that's it. And I know that the Sony menus are all nice touchscreen and colorful.
I can't understand the way Sony thinks about menus, and it's just...
Like the structure of the menu
hierarchy? Yeah, it's just never... And I worked with that mirrorless for months.
Yeah,
I took it out religiously, and I couldn't quite get it.
The new ones, the new Sony's, the A7 III series, and Gunther has one, so maybe we'll bring one over one time and have you take a look at it. Are more akin to the Canons, the kind of like old file structures, just like a list of options. But it really is, I think, goes down to whether you need an optical viewfinder. Do you like looking at the LCD or the OLED when you take a picture, or do you put your eye through an optical viewfinder?
You know, I do both. It's mostly that I really feel like I know how to utilize the Canon menu structure and camera to an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've gotten. I have enough experience with the Canon line that I can take a picture, and then when I look at it, I'm close to where I thought I was. And sometimes with the Sony, it's like, oh my God, I'm miles from where I think.
So the Canon has what, like a thumb wheel, a finger wheel, and then the big wheel on the back?
Has a nub and a big wheel.
And you can adjust the priority. I tend to choose the aperture and let the camera choose the speed.
Yep.
That gives me the most amount of control over depth of field.
It's funny. I have a photo book that my aunt, who is a photographer, gave me in like 1984 probably, that's like, The Kodak Guide to Amateur Photography. It has little pages on each thing. And the first thing it tells you is, look, always set your shutter priority. You want to avoid this depth of field business.
Oh, yeah.
Keep
your entire
shot in focus.
Right. Well, they weren't posting to Instagram, were
right.
they?
Right. I mean, it's just.
They
it's
didn't really care about
Vocalicious. Changing over 40 years. Yeah. And, you know, yeah.
The only recommendation I would say is that the 5D, which is now about 2 years old, does not have a flip out. A screen.
Oh,
so
really?
If you're going to be filming yourself in any capacity, you may want to look at.
I have people for that.
Okay, all right. And then you're going to be happy with it.
I just thought, what's the douchiest thing I could say at this moment? Oh, that was it.
Wait.
I'm the person.
Careful.
Don't offend the talent. Don't offend the talent, Norm.
It's like I'm looking around.
Before we continue with this week's episode, I want to let you know that Still Entitled is also made possible by Shaper. Take networking from awkward to awesome with Shaper, the number one professional networking platform that uses your experience, interests, and goals to help you make the right connections. Whether you're looking for investors, a co-founder, a new job opportunity, or just inspiring conversations, Shaper can connect you to professionals who truly want to share tips and help. Each day, it suggests 15 people with similar goals and interests for you to meet. Then all you have to do is take a few minutes to swipe through your daily profiles. Set up coffees with the people who stand out. If you're a professional, the Shaper app should be installed on your phone and you'll meet awesome people in no time. So download the app today or check out Shaper online at shaper.co. That's Shaper, S-H-A-P-R.co. To learn more about Shaper, download the app and improve the way you network. Now back to the conversation.
My mom just got back from Israel.
Oh, cool. Wow.
Yeah. So somebody on Twitter recently, somebody I follow, I've been following a lot of female journalists, and one of them, somebody on there was like, hey, post your most outlandish thing that you want and I'll support you. And it was just this sort of fun free-for-all where someone was like, I love this dress. And she's like, you deserve it.
Okay.
And somebody else was like, I love this puppy. And she's like, go get it. And somebody else was like, I want this ridiculous $5 million house in Garrison, New York. And they posted this Zillow ad for this ludicrous $5 million house in Garrison, New York. And I went and looked at it because I love real estate porn.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm flipping.
And here, like, just to be clear, here a $5 million house is like 4 bedrooms, 3 baths.
Yeah, no, it's
like on a
2,000 square foot house. Yeah,
5,000 square foot lot.
And I'm flipping through the pages of this Zillow listing. And it's bringing something up in my memory.
Oh, my.
And I text my mom and I'm like, hey, is this Doug and Sarah's old house? Because they had some very good friends. He worked on Wall Street. They were friends since I was in New York. So since like 68, 69, something like that. And they had this house that I remember going to. And I was right. This was a house that I grew up going to from ages like 7 to 12.
Oh, my.
How did
that make you feel?
Oh, it was amazing. So this house was ludicrous. It was so large. It had 3 sub-basements.
Wow.
So they could spend the winter in the first sub-basement because everything below ground is 65 degrees and you could have no heating bills over the winter. The house also had all these different levels. Like some closets had little tiny hobbit doors that opened into other closets and other rooms. Oh, it was amazing until you played hide and seek with their son. And then it was an unending nightmare because he could just like boop, 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 skip between the heat register from one room into the bathroom of another. And you'd never find
it. Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a Wes. This house is totally a Wes Anderson film.
Nice.
And it's this giant castle.
Can be yours for the bargain price.
$5 million. That was a weird trip down memory lane I didn't expect.
Did I tell you about the time I was on our architecture and they're like, what the hell were they thinking? Thread of that day featured my old apartment.
I saw you tweet that.
Really? Like,
your old apartment in San Francisco.
The one that you've been there.
I actually have never been there.
Oh, it might have been before I knew you.
Yeah. What was the distinguishing feature?
So I lived there from 2001 to 2004. It was a remodeled warehouse that was one of those quick up lofts in South Market. It's across from Costco at Division.
Got it.
And it was relatively inexpensive. We were paying $2,400 a month for two bedrooms and two baths.
Yeah.
1,200 square feet. Yeah. Glorious in San Francisco.
Yeah.
It had one problem. Through the kitchen, there was a five, six-inch steel girder that came diagonally out of the cabinets and stuck out about halfway into the main entry for the house.
Oh, I love that so much.
So
a tripping hazard.
Like, we literally looked at it and we were like, man, we've been in this 400 square foot apartment that we're paying almost the exact same thing for a year.
You can deal with it.
We're ready to go.
Yeah, we'll put lights all around it.
So the girder had a little bit of a flange just at the bottom that was almost exactly pinky toe width.
Oh, no.
So when you would get up in the middle of the night, go downstairs with the lights off to get like a drink, you never hit it with your shin. Like that would hurt, but it wouldn't be too bad. I bent my pinky toe all the way back at least three times on that thing.
It hurts so bad you can start to experiment with how well you can manage pain.
Yeah, like it was one of those ones like eventually I would get to the point that I wouldn't even scream loud enough to wake Gina up.
Yeah,
you just really like, nice. I thought
I do that when I hold the baby and hit something on my toe at night.
Oh so, yeah.
Totally. You just kind of suck that
totally.
Up.
Yeah, yeah. So that one was good. There's also
awesome that it was featured.
I like wrote them and I was like, hey, do you guys like the reason? Here's why it was like this, because it was like. They, in order to get the most square footage, that was where the beam was there.
Yeah.
And they just were slicing up the apartments to put the most square footage. Anyway, there's also a piece of land on Point Reyes, on the point across Tamales Bay from the mainland.
Yeah.
That's like 1,000 acres for only $13 million right now. So if anybody wants to, you know, get a farm up on West Sonoma.
Oh, well, I'm sure some billionaire would like to buy it and limit beach access like a douchebag.
Can't develop it.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, can't do anything with it. It's just for looking.
I've always wanted to do the kayak camping campground on Tomales at Point Reyes.
So I've done...
That's the one where you have to paddle across to it.
Well, you don't have to, but it's way easier.
Right.
It's either that or ride a horse in, basically.
Yeah, okay, so I don't have a horse, but I could get a, I could get a kayak easier
look,
than
you
I can find
a horse.
A horse
and a kayak, same place. They have them down at Dick's. We used to go and stay at a house across the bay. Just one of those stilled houses in the water, and watch basically waterfowl swim in the bay because it's awesome. And eat oysters and chuck the oyster shells back into the bay. And the whole anyway.
Oh my god!
The kayaking thing seems very good.
You're making me think of this. You know, there's a whole genre of real estate reality shows.
Yeah,
right. Very popular on HGTV and stuff. And
yeah.
I confess, we've been watching a lot of those with the baby in
You're
the
nesting.
House.
Capital gains,
exactly. And there's one that's just lakeside properties.
Right.
Wow. And, like, how many lakeside properties are there?
Oh,
I did not realize.
Infinite.
There are many, and these are folks who spent upwards of, like, $10 million on. And the range is, like, the $1 million, the $5 million, and a $10 million house lakeside in one episode. And I'm like, how is this even believable that these people are choosing between these three?
No.
They've already chosen one. And everything is for show.
The way those shows always work is that the person knows which house they're going to get.
Yes.
And they show them a couple of others to break them and make them sad that they're buying that house.
No, or they just want to be on television.
Yeah, well, that too.
The
canoe kayaking at Lake Sonoma in Sonoma County.
Yeah.
There's a half of the lake that there's no motorboats and is not really accessible by land. So you can load up a canoe with your stuff and kayak back there.
Nice.
And it's super easy and really nice. And you don't have to deal with waves and salt water and stuff.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
I want to do some camping again soon. I'm excited about the spring coming. And you know, it's rained like 35 days this year already.
Yeah.
It's really kicking our ass from a production standpoint. We keep having losing locations because they become mud pits.
Oh, like I've run the dehumidifier I empty the thing every two or three times a day so that we don't have mold in our house. It's great.
Yeah.
Living on the coast. Highly recommended. I think that's as upbeat a note as I have to end on.
I do have a plane to catch, but I want to know, because this is part, if you have lived in a funky house with interesting architecture and there are photos, Share with us.
I'll have to
photos.
Show you. So in the mid-90s, I moved in with my then girlfriend, who became the mother of my children. We moved into a 2,100 square foot empty space in an old mattress factory down in Yosemite in the Bayshore. And because it had no plumbing at all, it just had a water pipe sticking up out, I built a kitchen. And hell's bells, I wanted the loft from Diva, so I put a bathtub right in the middle of the living room.
Nice.
And it was I had my Diva loft for about 2 years. It was delightful.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I might still have some pictures of that.
I don't miss that bar, I'll tell you. The pole was
no,
bad.
I can't imagine you do. Yeah. Yeah, we'd love to see some pictures in the comments.
See all y'all right. Next week.
See it.
Bye, guys.
Did they do 30 Rock? 30 Rock had to be done in L.A., right?
That I don't think so. No, 30 Rock was
shot in New York?
It was shot at the studios in Queens.
Oh, okay.
Silver Cup Studios. And Silver Cup Studios has this giant sign on top. It's also where they filmed Highlander. And in the final battle of Highlander, the fight is on the roof of Silver Cup Studios with
the big Silver Cup
sign there. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wow. You're going to have to cut that in. It's good.
I will.
You want to start?
Welcome.
Let's do it.
To Still Entitled, The Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
No, do it again. Do it again. Okay. I talked over you.
Thanks for listening this week, and I want to remind you that Still Entitled is made possible in part by the fine folks at WiseCam. Wise is on a mission to make amazing smart home products accessible to everyone. Their Wise indoor camera is packed with premium features that allow you to see everything from anywhere for only $20. Whether you're checking to see if your kids are home safe or if your 3D printer has finished printing, nothing is off limits for WiseCam. Go to wise.com/untitled. That's WYZE.com/untitled to be guaranteed the lowest price available. And thank them for sponsoring this week's episode. We will see you next week.